was.
We'll call this first meeting of the Community and Regional Affairs to order. Good morning, I'm Representative Harris, and beside me is my co-chair, Representative Halcrow. And it's our pleasure to welcome members of the Community and Regional Affairs Department here this morning to give us an overview of their department. And since many of us are new to the legislature, I think it's we felt it was important that we had a kind of a brief overview, and it may get more than brief if members have questions. So many, some of our members aren't here this morning yet, but you can see by the nameplates who's on this committee. But Andrew, you want to say something here to start off?
Actually, why don't we just go ahead and get going? We'll have the Secretary, Chris Jones, read the roll.
For the record, I'd like to take the roll here. Representative Dyson is here. Representative Kukesh. Representative Harris and Representative Andrew Halcrow. Also with us this morning is our Secretary, Chris Jones, who will be our committee secretary. And my legislative aide, John Manley, to my right, and Andrew's Jonathan Lack to his left. First person we're going to hear from this morning is the Deputy Commissioner, Lamar Cotton. Lamar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lamar Cotton, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Community and Regional Affairs. And I see that our ranks are a bit thin here, so if you can bear with me a little bit, because I'm hoping that Ramon Henderson or...
Go slow, too.
Okay. Okay. We'll also be in attendance in a couple minutes. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with the chair, would be to give a kind of a brief overview on the department, followed by a little more detail by representatives from the four divisions, and then perhaps followed by questions about, frankly, any of the topics that we cover. Additionally, Mr. Chair, if I'm correct, you asked for a series of documents, and I believe that our staff has provided them. They're principally concerning revenues generated by rural communities, the bingo revenues, the sales tax revenues, and raw fish tax revenues. And those are principally from our own database along with the assessor's office. And if there are questions with that, I think I certainly can answer. There's also, you asked for some information about the PCE program as to who is currently participating in the program as well as since 1985, and then some issues about Head Start and JTPA and STEP, and I think hopefully that's on the way if it's not there in your packet. Just briefly, Community and Regional Affairs, the origin of the department was established in 1972. It's called the Local Affairs Agency was actually established, and the Constitution was in the Governor's Office prior to that. And I think under the Egan administration, there was a sense that there needed to be a consolidation of programs that not just focused on rural Alaska, but actually all municipalities. And I think that was sort of the genesis of the origin of the department. It has been, since its inception, I think one of the smallest departments. We currently have, I think, roughly 170, 175 employees. We have offices in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and then we have smaller offices in Bethel, Dillingham, Kotzebue, and Nome. Our largest office is Anchorage. I think we have roughly 55-60% of the employees live in Anchorage, and that's downtown Anchorage, at the, right above the post office mall. Joining actually here just to point out Ramon Henderson, which I'm glad to see, who lives out in the valley with the mile 95, is the director for administrative services. But as I mentioned, we have four divisions. They are Community and Rural Development, and the director of that is Yvonne Chase, and she's hooked up by phone. Principally, it's daycare and Head Start programs. Those programs, I think, have been with the division and the department since their inception, since the program's inception, along with JTPA, Job Training Partnership Act programs, and STEP, which is a State Training Employment Program, which is a program funded by, I think it's 1/10 of 1% of the UI fund, the UI Trust Fund. We have offices for those programs in the Nome, Bethel, and then Fairbanks and Anchorage, and here in Juneau. I think there's approximately 70 employees with the program. Again, I think Yvonne and certainly Ramon can give more detail about some of the day-to-day and how that division has evolved, and certainly with the Welfare to Work program and other things that have occurred in the last couple of years, how that division has played a major role in initiatives concerning children and then work programs. The other division, the one I think is viewed in some ways as the traditional division or the division that has the most outreach of municipalities, particularly in rural Alaska, and that's the Municipal and Regional Assistance Division. And that's had been in different shapes and form over the years, but it's involved in the more traditional programs such as pass-through programs with your revenue sharing, municipal assistance, and grants programs. It's is the program that is the outreach division for small rural communities with training for municipal officials. It works with, or has worked and continues to work with, those communities that have faced crises with respect to the downturn in timber and fish. The last 2 years, that division has probably been, along with the Division of Administrative Services, been directly involved in working with communities in Southwest Alaska as they've gone through the drop, both in quantity and the price problems they've had with the salmon industry. That division and my office has been also directly involved in the base closure activities, both at ADAC and in Fort Greeley. The third thing they do, which is probably a fairly ambitious program that was started 5 years ago, is a community development program, and we oversee that. And their staff is in that, even though it's in that division, they actually report to me directly. And that is a program where the federal government, through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, has taken 7.5% of the value of the what they call total allowable catch of pollock, and then in turn distributed those of that value to six fishing groups in Western Alaska, who in turn sell, if you will, the royalties for royalties or cash or training or equity position in boats to their partners or their fishing organizations. It's probably also the fact that the Coast Guard has been putting the gun to the state's head to say to clean these up, since they are ultimately responsible for safety concerning bulk fuel plants. I think we have worked very successfully on that program, and I think Percy Frisbee is online, can go into greater detail, but with Senator Stevens' office and a series of federal agencies, because they've been able to funnel money to the division and turn work with the communities in upgrading the bulk fuel plants. That division also involves with what's roughly characterized as alternative energy, and that involves wind projects, hydro, a couple other programs that I think Percy could go into more detail, but again, it's principally federal money that we in turn receive and then kick out to communities or oversee studies. The last, but certainly not least, division is the Division of Administrative Services, and that's Ramon Henderson, who's, I think, been reasonably successful in keeping us out of trouble and also in charge of our budget and finance, and also an integral part, really, of all the divisions because we do a lot of pass-through money and are involved in a lot of interactions, financial interactions with a lot of different communities. So kind of a thumbnail sketch, Mr. Chairman, and if you'd like, I assume somebody's online, but since I have Ike Waits here, who's been with the division for a number of years and not only is a manager and a supervisor, but also somebody who spends a lot of weekends in the field and I like to think has a lot more experience than I do, but Ike was going to give kind of an overview on the division, if you like, a little more in detail. Maybe you want to join me or...
I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome.
Thank you. For the record, again, my name is Ike Waits. I am officially called the Chief of Planning in the Municipal Regional Assistance Division, and it's my pleasure to be here today to represent our division on behalf of Director Pat Polin, who happens to be on a travel status at this point in time. Again, as Lamar Cotton alluded to, many of the functions that we perform are directly referenced in the Constitution, and for your information, those are specifically in Article 10 and Sections 12 and 14. And I always like to look at this to refresh my memory, but it calls for a branch in the executive, an agency in the executive branch to advise and assist local governments and also to collect and distribute information about the status of local governments. And again, as Lamar talked about, that information provision function is we're provided information today on municipal finances that comes from that. State assessor, I'm going to refer to page 6 in that overview for the that has a little chart diagram of Municipal and Regional Assistance Division. You find that? Okay. And the state assessor, which some of that information you got this morning, Chairman Halcrow, comes from the state assessor's records. And the state assessor is represented by box 1 on that chart. And basically, the state assessor's job is to oversee the property taxing efforts of local municipalities to make sure it's consistent with the state laws. And one of the other major functions that assessor does is he determines the full and true value of municipalities that are school districts, and that's directly that information is used in the calculation of what each district owes, if you will, towards the education system. So that's one of the major, those are the two major functions of the state assessor. The bingo receipts information that you were provided comes from our municipal financial records database. And basically that information we get from the certified financial statements and audits that all municipal governments are required to provide to us in return for getting, as a precondition to get the revenue sharing municipal assistance and program funds. And about 10 years ago, we started entering all that stuff in the database, and now we have a fairly good track record of this change in of municipal expenditures and revenues. It's as accurate as the information that the local governments give us, but that's where this information comes from. And that is maintained by the research and analysis section, which is basically box 6 on that chart. If you've had a chance to visit our community and regional affairs homepage, you've seen some buttons there for community profiles and other things. It's that section that also maintains that information and is frequently called upon by the legislature and by the governor to do some research and analysis and policy reports. So, in the revenue sharing and municipal assistance and other programs, we distribute about $54 million to local governments and unincorporated communities. And that assistance program is represented by box 7 on that chart, which is labeled Community Financial Assistance. And those programs. Lamar's mentioned a couple of them, revenue sharing and municipal assistance. It's now called Safe Community Funds. And then we have two pass-through programs, National Forest Receipts and Payments in Lieu of Taxes, which are handled under that financial assistance program. A major component of our effort is providing that training and assistance to councils, assemblies, planning commission members, and local government staff. And these activities are represented on the diagram by boxes 2, which is it says local government assistance and financial and utility management, and by box 3, which is the coastal management program and flood insurance program that Lamar had mentioned earlier, and also box 5, which is represents land management assistance and mapping efforts that we provide for local governments. Basically, our staff work with local governments on all aspects of local government operations, from interpreting Title 29 to conducting elections to writing stray dog ordinances to financial management. Whatever is involved in local government, we typically would get involved in it. Lamar's already talked about the field offices that we have where most of our staff are based that provide these services. In 1993, under this program, we decided it was important to concentrate on utility financial management, and so we created what we call a Rural Utility Business Advisor Program. Many of you may know it by its acronym, RUBA. And we did that because of what our staff were seeing as being a major issue in communities, and also because the two sanitation task force reports came out and said, gee, if we're making this investment, we need to help people deal with the financial management after they get it. So we've created that effort pretty much out of our overall assistance effort, and we have been acquired some federal money to support that program. The other thing that we never can forget and we're always reminded is financial management problems. Typically, if they exist in a community, there may be other local government issues there that require some training and assistance, and so essentially we end up getting involved in maybe what the role of the manager is, administrator is, and utilities, and those kinds of issues. So it's not just financial management. It's a whole approach to help communities get up to par for utility management. We also provide about $3 million in grants for community projects, and that's represented under Box 8, Community and Economic Development. That $3 million, that $3 million is principally federal money that comes through the Community Development Grant Program. And some examples of those projects are a landfill construction in Kobuk, fire protection ambulance equipment in Antioch, multipurpose facility in Whittier, and a Unicleet fish processing plant and salmon rearing facility in Cake. Those are just some examples. We give out about 30 grants a year, maximum $200,000 under that program. In 1988, the legislature created the Alaska Regional Development Organization Program. Many of you may know that by its acronym, ARDRS. This program encourages the formation at the regional, local level of economic development groups composed of private sector and public sector representatives to develop a regional strategy and implement that strategy. And this program is also represented under Box 8 there. And today there are 12 of those regional organizations around the state. And when it first started, the state contributed about $100,000 that was required to be matched to each of those programs. Now we're down to about $51,000 for each of those programs. We've divided the funds equally at this point in time. Right now we are in the process of recognizing a new ARDR it's called the Interior Rivers, and it's based in the Antioch area. And we anticipate applications from Fort Yukon area and the Fairbanks area. So those are pending applications, one of which we're in the process of actually recognizing.
We have one member that's interested in that area.
We might have. As I understand it, some of the Ardor people were in town this week and coming around and expressing their interest in that program to some of you. Lamar alluded to the Local Boundary Commission and our role as supporting that in staff, and that's represented by Box 4. And again, for reference to in the Constitution, that's actually Section 12, setting up the Local Boundary Commission and in Article 10. One of the other things that's occupied lots of our time that Lamar briefly hinted at is these coordinated response partnerships, which are formed by the governor, if you will, and called into play when there's some kind of disaster that's facing communities, economic disaster. And so far, we've been the ones that have been tapped to coordinate those multi-agency responses. And basically, the staff for these efforts are pulled out of Boxes 2, which is the local government assistance, and Boxes 8.
Representative, on that point of responding to communities with disasters, is that responding to them after a disaster has been declared or when the community indicates that they're in trouble?
To the chair, I was going to say we've been pretty informal about it. I think in the case of the fishery disaster, we didn't really wait for a declaration to be in the field and talking to people and trying to get an assessment.
Maybe more pointedly, when the city and also the Northwest Arctic Borough requested aid, did somebody from the department with this particular emphasis come out to check things out?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
It's been the standard response. And then I think it's the approach that's not the coordinated response partnership, the purpose of that is when there was a, quote, economic disaster before, it seemed like every agency sort of would kind of show up sort of at their own discretion. And so in the beginning of the last administration, this administration tried to do is have a little tighter organization and a little more purpose and mission when people would show up in somebody's community. And it would be the word coordinated, I think, was really lacking a lot of times. And we've probably been at fault as well as any other agency. So it's we've been sort of the point group and tried to, when somebody wants to show up, to kind of be the person, if you will, at the gate, so we don't get garbled and mixed messages and people going around in tight circles, which unfortunately is what some communities do after we have five different agencies show up with seven different messages. So hopefully this has been, you know, a little tighter run or, you know, process when people have said, hey, we got a trouble here, could you come out and talk to us? So.
For the record also, welcome Representative Morgan.
For being late. And it's perhaps instructive to look at the kinds of things that have typically triggered that effort to coordinate and develop partnerships. And again, one of them was the pending reductions at Fort Greeley, which will knock out about 75% of that community's, of Delta Junction's economic base. Of course, the timber situation in the southeast, and then most recently the fish disaster. So those are the kind of things that typically at this point in time trigger those efforts. Now, one of the things in the back of our mind is there are a lot of communities that I think that you might have been even alluding to that sometimes on their best days are still worse off than some of these communities might be that are having a disaster. And so it's kind of like, okay, why wait in terms of organizing these partnerships? And that's a question that I'm going to conclude with a little story about that came from Delta Junction.
that troubled time that they're going through today.
I think Lamar needs to answer that one.
Actually, I'm the point person for the administration on that project. So we are, in turn, and Ike's been working with the community prior to that for years with the local reuse authority planning group. And now the city, as you probably know, under House Bill 53 or the state law now, is going to be the local reuse authority that actually can receive ownership of the base. And so for the last 6 months, I've been working with the city director along with the other groups of interest. So as you well know, there was an election yesterday, an advisory election. It passed roughly 61-38 within the city. Didn't pass as well outside, but overall it was 43.5, 45.5, or 46.5. I spoke with the mayor yesterday, and they clearly want to continue their steps going forward with an RFP. They will initiate the RFP, and that's expected to have the steps involved in that is they're going to develop an RFP, and clearly the state's providing some technical assistance for both construction and operate a prison. Once they have a draft RFP, they wanted to float it, if you will, for a reality test amongst potential bidders, and then in turn put it out. Obviously, the bill, as everybody reads it closer, it's an interesting triangle between the state, which will receive and pay for services, the city, which will own the facility, and then in turn hire a private operator to construct and operate it. And it's going to take a lot of cooperation for all three, and I think all three have some fairly vested interest, if you will. The private company obviously wants to make money. The city wants a lot of things to ensure their community doesn't go the, quote, the wrong way or loses its way in the complicated process. And the state wants to have a, you know, meet certain safety and business practices running a corrections institution, which they've never done through private service, and clearly do it in a financially or fiscally responsible way. And that sounds like a soundbite, but I found it to be a very complicated topic, and there's a lot of pitfalls ahead of us, I think, in terms of walking through this. But as always, I'd be happy to talk to you about it in more detail. And I know we have some, I don't know if you've gotten, we did a community survey and some other detail. Okay, I'll provide that to you, your office.
Your department will help them through the when they're going through these processes.
Right, and I think that Ike actually has been the lead person for a couple of years as he sifted through about possible research for this cold weather testing station, and not surprisingly, there hasn't been a lot of takers or interest aside from the issue of the first private prison in Alaska. So, I mean, there are some, just a side notes, you know, it's the only place in Alaska there's a nuclear power plant, and there's a few other sort of interests, and they can't really account for all the nerve gas casings or whatever it is. I mean, it's been a there's an interesting Cold War story behind the one.
Are you done with the
yes.
Delta part? Mr. Chairman, back to the disasters for just a second. In the process of trying to make a determination who would qualify for the disasters with regards to the fish, the group that was working on it was working on a matrix to make the determination of where different communities that were requesting assistance from the farm. Has that matrix been completed, and has the final determination been made as to who qualified or not? And can I get a copy of that?
To the chair, Representative Jewell, let me find out. I don't know about the matrix, to be honest about it, and I've been in and out of the topic. I know the department in this division, along with the Veteran Military Affairs, has been the lead on some of the particulars on that, particularly because of the way that division, that department relates to the federal government. But let me try to get the information to you directly. I know it's always been controversial as to where the boundaries went. You know, there was a declaration, and then on top of that, the federal government, SBA, then said anybody adjacent to the declared disaster would qualify for SBA financing. So there's sort of two layers of assistance. So let me, I'll get that to you soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wade, I have several questions for you on some of your divisions here. First, let me start with the State Assessor's Office, the area that handles the State Assessor. I know in municipalities such as Anchorage, Regional Property Tax Department, their own assessor. They obviously follow state law, which mandates that you assess property to the fullest value. What is this situation out in rural Alaska where there is no property taxes? In the revenue generated from property taxes, are they exempt? Is it similar to Department of Motor Vehicle rules where under a certain amount of people or cars they're exempt from state regulations?
Well, they're not exempt from state regulations. If any municipality choose to do a property tax, then they would fall. They have to follow Title 29, and then, of course, the state assessor would be part of that effort to see that they were doing it in the same manner as the municipality of Anchorage is doing it when they follow the law.
You had mentioned the $3 million for grants, and it looks like your Community and Economic Development Division has a number, has kind of an umbrella over a number of different organizations. The $3 million, you had mentioned some projects. When I think about economic development, I think about creating situations where people have ongoing jobs and creating some kind of revenue stream, some kind of industry for the community. Can you go through once again some of the grants and what they were for? Because I kind of missed that.
Oh, sure. Okay, sorry about that. First, let me touch on the name because of that section. We call it Community and Economic Development. I didn't talk about some of the pieces that are the more the economic development side of that. They're represented by the loan, small business loan. I did touch on the ARDRs, which is part of that economic development grant. The most of the communities have chosen to use the community development block grants for community infrastructure type projects, some of which can be tied to a needed infrastructure to support economic development. And for example, one of the ones I mentioned that might fit that category would be the salmon rearing facility, if I remember my notes right. And then also in Unalakleet, they contributed money towards the fish processing plant that other park people did. So in a sense, it's kind of like the government would contribute money that would then in turn benefit a private outfit, and that's how that economic tie might be there, or they might put in a facility that gets leased out. A lot of the communities choose to use this more along the lines of the fire trucks and fire halls and clinics and that sort of infrastructure. So it depends on the community. If you use it for economic development, the HUD rules are pretty stringent about number of jobs created per dollar amount of money spent, and it's tough to meet those standards, so a lot of communities don't go that way.
I'm just going to follow up. I think what we find is a lot of communities, before you're going to attract the private sector to risk the dollars, there has to be some fundamental, quote, community development in place, the utilities, roads, waterfront development. In a lot of places, that's where this money goes because it's simply not there to in turn entice somebody to take the risk, whether it's a fish plant or a tourist operation. So a lot of times it is mundane for some people, maybe. I'm not suggesting you, but for us, it is the sort of the meat and potatoes of what we do. And whether it's just simply assisting directly through financial assistance or a grant or training to make sure that the utilities run, pretty critical to the community. And if that's never properly in place, frankly, it's going to be a pretty big discouragement from anybody wanting to invest anything there. So,
if I may add to that, for point of reference, perhaps, given that you're from the municipality of Anchorage, the community development block grant funds that the municipality of Anchorage gets go straight to the community, to Anchorage.
Correct.
And they can spend it on about the same things.
It's the same program.
Same rules apply, et cetera.
We do have, Mr. Chairman, a list of all the projects, and be happy to provide that to you.
Sure.
I mean, a whole catalog of what we've provided, what's the money we have in turn conveyed to communities. So I'll put that on my list.
My final question has to do with the ARDRs program. You had mentioned your funding's basically down to 51. You had mentioned 12 regions and $51,000. Is that $51,000 per region or $51,000 total that's divided among the 12 regions?
51,000 per region.
Per region, okay. So you have 12 regions that get 51,000 per year. How does that relate to your overhead?
How does that relate?
If you have 12 regions and they get a grant of 51,000, are they doing more than just distributing those ARDR dollars?
Oh, the ARDRs themselves, that supports that operation. And typically they have to, depending on their status under the rules, they have to match that money. For example, in the municipality of Anchorage, the Anchorage Economic Development, I forget what they call it, the name of it. I have to look it up. I get it confused. But that Patty DeMarco shop gets
ADC.
That's right. And they get $51,000 there, but they match it with other money that they get from membership and stuff like that. And Kenai, it's the same way. And in the one in Lower Yukon, they have to make less of a match because of their status, but they still have to come up with a match.
Why wouldn't, since, for instance, if this program includes the Valley of Anchorage, why wouldn't this program seem more suitable to be under Commerce and Economic Development? It's just kind of been an outgrowth of your department, but...
Well, that actually, it was in the department, and a couple of years ago, we moved it over here because it's really a community-based, and frankly, a lot of the ones that we thought needed more direct assistance were those in rural Alaska where this department has outreach offices, and Commerce does not. And frankly, it's similar to some other programs, I think, more that particularly this division has worked with.
Yes, just for information's sake, you know, you mentioned ANIAC and the, you know, as far as the economic benefits on these block grants that we do get, like the fire station, the fire equipment we got this last time, it dropped our fire insurance down, therefore saving the community, the school district, the business, their fire insurance dropped. And it, you know, and it saved them a lot of money, just on insurance alone. You know, and so that was, it's an economic development. Then they get more money to spend at one place that they do save. And in the ARDR, for the $50,000 that we get in what we're applying for the ARDR, and I'm a member of that ARDR, we're serving 14 communities. So, you know, if you look at it, $50,000 don't go very far. No. For a point of information.
If I may I quote your testimonial? Oh, okay. I'll wrap it up here then. And the story I wanted to talk about comes from Delta. As Lamar said, I was involved early on as they were developing their strategies, and we were instrumental in getting the federal money that's helped them develop the strategy. P.R. Miller, you may know him, I don't know. He came up to me. He's a fairly crusty old-timer, I guess, in a positive sort of way to describe Mr. Miller. And we had just finished a session where we were working on what might be some options to pursue and to spend some consultant money on. And he comes up to me and he says, "Ike, we're the lucky community." And I was pretty blown away by that, because here this community's facing a reduction that amounts to 75% of its economy disappearing because of a government decision. So I asked him, I said, "How can you be lucky?" And this is what his answer was. "We've been told about these cuts and given 6 years to prepare for them. Plus, the feds are giving us money to hire consultants and to look for an effort to recover from this." And he says, "You know, there are a lot of other small towns in Alaska which are just as dependent on government spending for their economy, and they're not going to get this advance notice of these kind of cuts. It's going to creep up on them, and one day it'll happen, and there won't even be a disaster declared for it, because it'll be there. They'll just wake up, and that'll be there." And that comment really got me to thinking and wondering what local government officials will be facing as time goes by, as they face that squeeze between pretty much flat, if they're lucky, government spending in the communities,
and increasing number of kids needing to meet their economic well-being in that community. So that's led us to begin working on a community development strategy type program where we are preparing to assist local councils begin to develop strategies and to deal with that situation and provide the leadership so that they can meet the demands of their constituents to basically do something about our economic situation. So that's pretty much what we've started to focus some of our efforts on at this point in time. And to me, the Arters, as well as all regional efforts that we can get to focus on this issue, is our goal to get them to focus on that. I'd be happy to answer any more questions about what we're doing and what we foresee, and certainly provide you whatever information you would like that we have. Thank you very much.
We do have people on teleconference here that have been patiently waiting, so they wish to.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, if I could, maybe I could ask Yvonne Chase, who is the Division Director for Community and Rural Development, to give a quick and concise overview on her responsibilities and the mission of her division.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Yvonne Chase, and I'm the Director of the Division of Community and Rural Development. Is this a good volume?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. There are three major areas in my division. The first one is early childhood programs, and that includes Head Start and child care. The second one are job training programs, and those include JTPA, STEP, and Welfare to Work. And the third area is the AmeriCorps program, which is also a part of this division. I will just briefly go through the three sections, and I'll pause at the end of the section since I'm having to provide you this information in this faceless capacity. So I'll take a pause to see if there are any questions after I cover each section, if that's all right with the committee.
Very good. Thank you.
Lamar, are the handouts there?
Yes. Kim is on top of it, as always.
All right. Great. The first programs I'd like to discuss are the early childhood programs, being the very first one. And the goal of Head Start is really to bring about everyday effectiveness in dealing with, for children, in dealing with their environment and later responsibilities in school, to really make them ready to learn when they reach K through 12. The Head Start program, as you many of you probably know, has been around since 1963. It's a national program that has an excellent track record. We have a combination of state and federal funding, and what I've provided you on the first chart for Head Start is a map that shows where the Head Start grantees are and the combined federal and state funding for each one of those grantees. Some of the grantees, there are a number of Head Start sites, and I have the listing on the next page. Just couldn't fit it all on the map. But you'll see there that there's a total of approximately $21 million. I do want to point out that communities also support the Head Start programs. By the community coming up with a facility or in other ways contributing to the cost of Head Start. The communities actually provide approximately 15% of the total, and I don't have the community funding figured in there. So it's $21 million plus the 15% that actually is raised within the community. Our state funding is about 24% of the total. We serve right now in Alaska approximately 23% of the children and families who qualify for Head Start services. But we still have a number of unserved children and families that could benefit from the Head Start program were it available in their community. The third page that I've provided you, just an overview of the Head Start program from FY92 through 98. And last year in the in last year's legislative session, there was discussion in a number of the committees about measurements and how programs measure their success. Obviously, one of the things we look at are the total number of children or families that we serve, and I highlighted that. You'll see that our numbers have consistently gone up in terms of the overall number of families served. But there are a couple of other ways that we look at the success of particularly the Head Start program. In terms of making sure that children are ready for school when they enter kindergarten or the first grade, there are a number of screenings that are done as part of the overall Head Start program and immunization. So we make sure that children who leave Head Start actually have had all their immunizations at the time that they were supposed to have them, as well as having dental follow-up and any kind of medical screening that may actually identify some problems or potential problems that, if we are able to address them early in the child's life, may have literally no bad effects. One of the other ways that we measure the success of a program is by the amount of training that staff receive. And then we look at that and compare it to staff turnover. And we found that in early childhood programs, whether it's Head Start or child care, that programs that offer more training and consistent training to their staff, the last few years that I've highlighted here. The next area that I highlighted is the area that said staff is or was a Head Start parent. Because not only is Head Start a program for children, but it's also an employment possibility for parents. And we have a high percentage of parents whose children have been in Head Start who are now Head Start staff. And there again, you can see that we've gone from, in 1992, 225 staff who were former Head Start parents or present Head Start parents, up to 321. The last two things that I highlighted in Head Start for you were the total cost per child, what portion of that is the state cost per child when you look at the breakout of funding, and then the total number of funded child slots in Head Start. That is a very quick overview of the Head Start program. Any questions before I move on to child care?
I have a question, Ms. Chase. This is Co-Chairman Halcrow. You had mentioned measuring success, and you had only mentioned one measurement, one benchmark, and that was the number of children served. Do you have any other benchmarks that measure how well you're doing with this program?
Yes, we do, and I would be happy to provide you the complete list. I was just trying to be really brief. But one of the measurements are, in fact, the number of children that have had complete screenings, whether it's a medical screening or dental screening. Every Head Start child goes through a fairly continuous, over the number of years that they're in Head Start, reevaluation in terms of their learning needs and any special services that may be needed for them. So one of the things that we look at are how many high-risk children did we identify and what services did they get during that period of time. And then their progress is actually charted through each year that they're in Head Start to see where they are at the beginning, where they are at the end. And there has been some research nationally that has looked at what happens to children in the regular school system who have actually gone through the Head Start program. And they find that depending on the school system and what it offers, actually Head Start children in most cases, one, do very well and sometimes do much better than children who've not been through a Head Start program. But I would be happy to provide you the fairly long list that we have.
Thank you.
Shall I move on to child care?
Yes.
Within the child care program, the first page that I have provided you that has a map, again, of Alaska, shows you the communities in which we have child care programs. And what I've tried to do is to break out the child care programs by the various local administrators. The way in which we administer this program is not through a centralized state agency, but actually by having contractors who are local administrators who serve a large geographic area. So, for example, the one in Fairbanks, which serves a large area and will serve any families within that area. The same thing with the one in Kotzebue. What I've listed at the there are the total amount for the child care subsidies. Now, the child care program has two major functions. One is to make subsidies available for families who otherwise would not be able to be in the workforce, because they wouldn't have safe, quality child care that they could afford. Our goal is to have child care that's accessible, that is available when they need it. If you find out you have a job next Monday, you need to know that there are some child care options immediately available for you. To have child care that, particularly in the urban areas, that isn't on the other side of town and away from your place of employment, so that you end up spending the majority of your morning or evening in transportation, but rather something that is hopefully convenient for you as a parent. Things that will really assist the parent in being able to gain and retain a job and know that their child's in safe, safe child care. The other part of the child care program, in addition to the subsidy, is called the Child Care Grant Program. And the purpose of the grant program is to assist child care providers in increasing the quality of child care throughout the state. There have been a number of studies, both in the state but also nationally, that show that the quality of child care has a very direct relationship on some of the things that we're finding out affect children in those early years prior to kindergarten or first grade. The second page, the second handout that I've provided you gives a listing of the funding in the child care programs for the last 4 years, listing first the child care grant. The child care grant has historically been a state funds only grant. This year for the FY 2000 budget, the administration is proposing actually a combination of state and federal funds in that child care grant. The subsidy program, then, you'll see, is broken into two categories, the federal subsidy funds and general subsidy funds, and then the total. I need to point out on this chart that if you look at FY 97 to 98, with total families served and then total children served, you'll see that the number of families is actually decreasing while the number of children are increasing. We took a look at that to figure out what was happening, and I think that what we're finding is that one of the things that we've had a very big focus on for the last year and a half are families who are moving from welfare to work. And so we may have more children per family in a category that could be served by child care programs. In other words, younger than kindergarten age. And I think that's what we're seeing there, because we are definitely seeing an increase in the number of children. pause there for a minute on child care. Any questions?
Yes, Ms. Chase, this is Representative Harris. One question just quickly here. Is this program operated by state employees, or is this contracted with the private sector to provide this, or how is this operated?
This program is operated mainly as a grant program. We have a small state staff. As you can see, the child care office staffing on the second handout that I provided you with a number of full-time positions are only 9 positions. And the local administrators that I mentioned are actually grantees. I'm not sure where we came up with the term local administrators years ago, but they are, in fact, a combination of nonprofit and governmental agencies. For example, in Anchorage, the municipality of Anchorage is in fact, the local administrator. In other areas, it may be a small nonprofit agency.
And they just basically administer the grant and make sure that the services are taken care of by some.
They administer the grant. In terms of making sure that the services are there, they provide, they do all of the authorizations, eligibility determinations for the parents who are applying for subsidies for child care. They process all of the paperwork and do continual re-eligibility determinations.
Okay, my only concern, I guess, will be as we go along is that the money really goes to the service that's needed, not to bureaucracy or somebody taking a big chunk of it off the top.
I would agree with you. I think that you will find that the local administrators operate on basically a shoestring of administrative costs, because the real goal here is to be sure that a major bulk of these funds get to the parents who need them.
Very good. We welcome Representative Murkowski to the. Any other questions? Okay, I guess we're ready to move on.
The last section that I wanted to discuss with you is more, well, actually two sections. First, the AmeriCorps program. The AmeriCorps program is really described as the domestic counterpart to the Peace Corps and operates very similar. One of the things that we are able to do with the AmeriCorps program are to provide very small stipends to individuals who will set aside a year of their life to volunteer in a community and work in various capacities in agencies to assist communities with things that they need. This year, we've been able to also begin what is called education-only awards. And that's, I think, a very neat part of the program because it allows students to participate as AmeriCorps members and to, by doing that, be able to actually gain some funding towards their tuition or towards paying off some of their school loans, which in the long run helps us as a state as well. Let me move quickly, if I can, on to job training programs. Within job training, there are 3 major areas, the JTPA program, the STEP program, and the Welfare to Work program. And what you will see on the charts that I've provided you are the first 2. But I want to explain all 3 first. The JTPA program, Job Training and Partnership Act, is a federally funded program, does not require a state match, and is in the process of moving now as a result of federal legislation that was just passed this last session of Congress to become the Workforce Investment Act. So JTPA, in the letters at least, will go away the 1st of July of the year 2000. The funding will be there for the same kinds of things. So there are some changes that the federal legislation requires, but conceptually it's moving in the same direction. Within JTPA, we perform six functions. We administer through what we call service delivery areas. And presently, we have three service delivery areas in the state. Anchorage and Mat-Su are one. The balance of the state is a second one. And the third one is Fairbanks. And I will mention Fairbanks a little bit more in a couple minutes. But the SDA directors actually administer a variety of job training programs, JTPA, the Welfare to Work, STEP program, and also some funding through the Older Alaskans Commission targeting seniors for training and work placement. We coordinate program activities to avoid duplication and maximize the leverage of funds across those funding sources. At a state level, ensure fund expenditures and compliance with the program. So we have an oversight responsibility in the state office for the programs across the state, as well as for developing and implementing policies and staying in compliance with federal policies and procedures. We provide training and technical assistance to the grantees, and in some cases through a rapid response subsection of our unit at the state level also provides some direct services to dislocated workers. The STEP program is a state funds only program. Those funds come from the UI Trust, and really the goal of the STEP program is also job training, but it is measured by looking at the number of individuals who file for unemployment claims. If we're able to keep the unemployment claims down, then hopefully we've done a good job at targeting the right individuals at a time when they need the training and sometimes alternate training in terms of a new occupation so that they can stay in the labor force. The Welfare to Work funds, and I will need to provide you some additional breakouts on those if you would like those as well, because what I did on these sheets was to break out JTPA by adult programs, youth programs, and economic disadvantaged workers, and then to show you STEP, and I ran out of room on the page. The Welfare to Work funding is funding that comes in from the U.S. Department of Labor. This department is the grant recipient for those funds. We work jointly with the Division of Public Assistance in HESS because those funds are targeted at the hardest to serve of welfare recipients. And by the hardest to serve, the feds have a specific criteria. Individuals who have been on public assistance 30 months or more and have two of the other three criteria. And the other three criteria are a substance abuse problem, a poor work history, or the lack of a high school diploma or a GED. Interestingly enough, Alaska's finding, and many of the other states are as well, that the three criteria in addition to the 30 months are really narrowing the funding almost too much to be really useful for us, because the lack of a poor job history may sound like a reasonable criteria, but when you look at the way the federal government has defined it, many of the individuals in Alaska who are seasonal workers actually don't fit because of the way they've narrowly defined the criteria. The other thing that they've defined in terms of the lack of a GED or a high school diploma, they've looked at just having the piece of paper as opposed to the competency level. So we may have individuals who have a GED or a high school diploma, but have a reading comprehension at lower than what may be expected in terms of job readiness, and still need to do some retraining for those individuals. Let me point out just a couple things about the handouts that I provided you. I think there was a request from the committee to look at success ratios for JTPA back through 1994. I was not with JTPA in 1994, but we had a different MIS system, Management Information System, and when they converted the data, I understand in 95, much of what we had before is actually lost. I will go back and try to attempt to get the other 2 years for the committee, but I wanted to be able to at least provide you with 96, 97, and 98. I wanted to just mention the way in which the success ratios are determined. If you look at the participants in any of those categories, the terminees then are a subset of the participants, and those employed are a subset of the terminees. That gets you the success ratio. For JTPA programs, the national goal point is about 59%, and states adjust their rates and their goals based on some state-specific factors, like number of individuals who fit into the poverty range and number of percentage of unemployed and a couple of others. So we end up actually with a lower percentage rate, although we still aim always for the national one. When I looked at the STEP figures, and I wanted to point this out because I'm sure when you look at it, you'll have the same question. On both FY 97 and 98, the numbers for STEP, in particularly in Fairbanks, are very low. And one of the things that we didn't do on this chart, and I'd be glad to go back and add these figures for you, is that in addition to the regular terminees in the program, we also have the ability to actually, we have another category of terminations, and those are under a category called retraining. And the effort there is to retrain individuals with new skills in either the same occupation or another occupation while they're still employed, so that they don't end up on the unemployment rolls and have to draw unemployment. So we were successful in doing that, but what happens is they don't show up in the way we've calculated these terminations. So I will provide you some additional material so that you can see what that effect is in some of the regions. And Fairbanks is certainly one of the regions where we've ended up with a lot of individuals to fit into that category. I think I'll take a breath there and see if there are any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Jay. This is Representative Halcrow. I was wondering, I was hoping you could walk me through this chart a little bit. I'm not quite sure I understand the way it's laid out. You have participants, total participants in welfare participants, and then underneath it's terminees. Could you clarify what terminees are? Are they people that dropped out of the program or people that were dropped out of the program?
Actually, no. We use the word terminees for people who terminate the program. In other words, who complete. I think we might want to find a more positive term for that. But a couple of my lines are missing. If you look at on the left-hand side of the chart, the JTPA adult program for any year, if you take FY 97, you'll see the funding is broken out. funding is actually broken out into the three areas that we provide funding: the balance of state, Anchorage MATSU, and the Fairbanks Borough. If you look at the top, then the total participants for the adult program were 472 for balance of state. Of those 472, 212 were welfare recipients. Of the 472, 275 completed the program. At the time that this fiscal year ended and we looked at those figures, which doesn't mean that that the other ones weren't going to successfully complete the program, but they could still be in training. Of those 275, 153 were employed, and that's where we end up with a success ratio of 55.6. Of the, looking now of the welfare recipients that were in that total for balance of state, the 212, 122 of those individuals completed the program, and 68 were employed at the end of that fiscal year when the statistics were collected, for a success ratio of 55.7.
Okay, let me just stop you there, because I have a little bit of concern with these numbers. If you start a given program with 472 people, and the mission of the program is to train these folks to go out into the workplace and get employment, at the end of the day, out of those 472, if 153 are gainfully employed, wouldn't that be how you arrive at your success ratio?
No, and the reason that it wouldn't be is that of the 472, the others are still in the program. So what we look at are the number who've completed the program, and of that who completed the program at the time, we do a cutoff of statistics for that particular fiscal year. So if 275 have completed the program at the end of the fiscal year, then what percentage of those individuals are employed? Because the others are not a negative in that they're not employed because they haven't completed their training.
Okay, so it's almost like a rolling total.
Yes, unfortunately, it is a rolling total because people are able to enter the program and leave the program at all different times of the year. And one of the things that we try to do is be there to meet the needs of the individual. And as you know, we're not always sure when layoffs are going to occur or when other things happen that cause people to be referred to JTPA or one of the other programs. So they may come in at different times of the year and start training at different times of the year. Someone may start in late April in a program that actually is going to finish in October. They're not going to show up. They will show up as a participant because they're a new participant in this fiscal year. They won't show up as a terminee yet because they haven't completed or dropped out of the program.
Okay, and the different programs you offer, let's take through the STEP program, the different programs you offer, what is the average length of training?
The training really varies in terms of length. Generally, I would say about 3 to 6 months is the longest. There are some exceptions, but the real focus of the training is to give people marketable job skills as quickly as possible to move them into or back into the workforce. And I can provide the committee with a list of types of training that's done, types of job positions that people go into, occupations, and I would be happy to do that as well.
Okay. Thank you. Chase, Representative.
One other thing that I wanted to mention in terms of a Fairbanks borough area is that we received a request, the department received a request several months ago from the Private Industry Council in Fairbanks asking us to consider taking on the administrative and grantee responsibility for these programs that they were overseen through the Fairbanks SDA, Service Delivery Area. The reason, there were a couple of reasons for that. One was in anticipation of some of the changes in the new federal legislation that I mentioned to you, the Workforce Investment Act. Private industry councils, better known as PICs, cannot run their own programs. And the way in which this PIC was constructed, those individuals actually directly supervised the director, and so therefore were more like a board of directors in an agency that ran programs. They all have their own jobs and found that they really needed an administrative entity that was focused on these programs. We began the process of moving to absorb those functions into the statewide SDA, which covered that geographic area with the exception of Fairbanks, and have just recently completed that process.
Davis, or Ms. Chase, I mean, Representative Harris, how closely do you work with the university on these retraining services?
Actually, very closely. And again, it depends in terms, it certainly varies by area as to how many individuals who move through job training may be involved in the university training programs. But we work very closely with them through the SDA directors and an individual client basis.
Okay, and the PIC Council, do they try to do that as well?
Yes, actually, the PIC Councils are there to provide local representation and to be sure that the kinds of training that we're seeking for individuals really mirror what the market needs are. That concludes my remarks, unless there are additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on teleconference?
Mr. Chairman, this is Percy Frisby, Division of Energy.
Welcome.
I guess I'm up next.
I think you're up next, yes.
Okay, I have, I have six components in my division. I have bulk fuel system upgrades, rural power system upgrades, electrical emergencies, alternative energy programs, and I have loans and power cost equalization. And I guess to start with, I could begin with the bulk fuel upgrades and what that program really is. What we do is we are working with the U.S. Coast Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to upgrade leaky tank farms. And in most cases, we're ending up having to go in and do complete rebuilds and consolidation in most of these communities. We work with EPA not only in a compliance schedule, but we also work with them as a partner, in which they bring to the table about $3 million a year to do these tank farm constructions. We're dealing with 210 communities. In most of these communities, we have anywhere from 3 to 7 individual tank farms in the communities in which we're trying to consolidate to one site of liability. So we're looking at roughly about 3,000 tank farms in rural Alaska that we have to upgrade. My rural, as I go through this, if you have any questions of these, I guess would be.
We'll stop you if we have any questions.
Okay. I'll move on to my rural power system upgrades. We do all the analysis and determinations on how efficient these systems are. We also go out and do inspections in terms of needs, such as some of these communities have systems out there that are 20, 25 years old, and we have distribution systems that are literally, in some communities, falling down. So we have to go out and deal with and try to put together financial packages to replace distribution systems. We do a lot of powerhouse upgrades, and in some communities we do complete system renewal. In other words, change the powerhouses out and install a new one. Again, we work with federal agencies in terms of trying to put financial packages together to complete most of these projects. We do have also electrical emergencies that we deal with, and on an annual average, we deal with roughly about 4 emergencies a year, and those vary from transformers going out to complete system shutdowns. And we have the alternative energy program, in which we have partnered up with the federal DOE in the past, and we were involved in a wind energy project up in Cottsville, which is a demonstration project. We're trying to determine whether or not wind can be applied in rural Alaska and how efficient and effective that system is. We're also doing a partnership, again, with federal DOE, as well as Chugach here in Anchorage, and we're looking at battery energy storage projects. We're trying to develop a hybrid system that's going to use battery storage to supplement diesel generation, and that mainly would be used in small communities in rural Alaska. We're also, with Chugach, looking at solid oxide fuel cells, and we're trying to determine whether or not that technology as well can be applied not only in rural Alaska but in urban Alaska. And we are looking at possibilities of tidal energy in Cordova. We're trying to do the feasibilities, or we're in the process of doing a feasibility study on that, and we wanted to see what areas and how small of a system that we can scale tidal energy down to, and maybe if in fact we can get it down to really small communities, we might be able to use it on the coastline. We're also looking at ethanol, biomass, and we're working in two areas. We're working down in southeast, and we're working up in Dot Lake and McGrath, trying to use southeast. We're looking at the wood waste and whether or not we can extract enough ethanol out of wood waste to make that a feasible project in terms of being able to supply ethanol to the larger cities in the state. My loan programs, I have two loan programs. I have the Power Project Loan Fund, which is basically for every utility in the state of Alaska is eligible, and we loan dollars for electrical system upgrades. We can also loan dollars for water system upgrades. Any type of utility upgrade we can loan dollars for. And then, of course, I have my power cost equalization program, which is an equalization program for rural communities in rural Alaska. And do you have any questions?
Yes, Mr. Frisby. This is Representative Halker. I have several questions regarding your division. First, let me ask you about your bulk fuel program. These 3,000 tank farms, did the state absorb the cost of putting these tank farms in, and now they're absorbing the cost of going through and repairing these, for instance, when the Coast Guard raised concerns about health and safety? So if I understand you right, not only did the state pay to put these 3,000 tank farms in, but we're also paying to go out and repair these. Is that correct?
No, it's we're going out to we're going out and matching federal monies to repair tank farms. Most of the tank farms that I'm talking about in rural Alaska, to my understanding, was installed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The only tank farms that the state paid for installed in rural Alaska was the school district tank farms, and that basically was the REA school districts.
Mr. Chairman? Just, I think, and that's, as Percy mentioned, that's been our linkage and our basis for our conversation and assistance from the congressional delegation, which is where the lion's share of the money's come, is the linkage has been the federal presence in rural Alaska over the years, who they, in turn, were the ones who put those tanks out there, didn't meet the code or didn't keep them up. And so that's been able for us to be the point group, if you will, the division Percy's a director of, to, in turn, receive those federal funds and work with those installations.
Okay, my question is, we still use state matching funds to repair these, we're using state matching funds to repair these tank farms.
Yes, but it's a small percentage.
Thank you. My
Mr. Chairman, give you an example. I get a 1.6 general fund appropriation and have been for the last 3 years for bulk fuel system upgrades. We use those dollars to match, in some cases, federal money. In some cases, we use it for just doing a complete project. And some of the projects that we fund out of that are the very small projects, which are in the neighborhood of $150,000 to $200,000. But for the most case, we match federal dollars, and the percentages in terms of Fed versus state, we have $1.6 million a year. And to give you an example, in the last 3 years, we've got the $1.6 for 3 years, and we've brought $28 million in federal funds back to the state with that match ratio.
Thank you, Mr. Frisby. My next question has to do with PCE. Can you tell me who qualifies for PCE, for instance? Is the program, the reimbursement, is that eligible? Is everybody that lives in a community, for instance, if I live in Bettles and I make $100,000 a year, it's not dependent on my income, it's just if I live in a community that is involved, is a participant in the PCE program, do I get to take advantage of that?
Yes, the way the program works is the utility is the entity that qualifies for the program, and we do not go through and determine whether or not the ratepayers, you know, we don't have any qualification criteria for individual ratepayers.
Okay.
So if you do make $100,000 a year and live in Bettles, as you explained in your example, and a utility qualifies, you would be a recipient of the PCE program as well.
My next question with PCE is with regards to conservation. When you have a program like this that, in my opinion, that reimburses somebody a percentage of what they spend, there's really no incentive to conserve. And my question to you is, looking at the state statute, I know you require, I think it's the providers, the utility companies, to take certain steps to minimize costs. I know that's in state statutes, but is there any programs afoot that would hopefully motivate the consumers to conserve?
The Division of Energy last year just started what we call the Rebuild America program, which is a federally funded program. And that program is 100% conservation in terms of what we do with it is train individual ratepayers, homeowners, and also go on to public facilities and do energy audits to try to determine the use of energy and how we could improve the efficiencies not only in the public facilities as well as in the individual homes. So yes, we are developing, we have a program that looks at conservation, and in addition to that, we're trying to expand that so we can we can educate, if you will, individuals on the proper use of electricity. I don't know if that is coming across correct, but there's a lot of people out in rural Alaska as well as urban Alaska that leave a lot of lights on, if you will, for no reason, and that eats up kilowatts.
Okay. And my final question is really the goal and the focus of the program. Reviewing a Division of Energy document, it was published in July of 97. In the introduction, it mentioned that there were 180 communities, participating in the PCE program, and it looks like today there are now 196 communities participating in the PCE program. So it looks like instead of creating an atmosphere where we're weaning people off this subsidy, we're actually expanding it. With the shrinkage of state dollars, that concerns me greatly. Is there any effort in your department to, for instance, these communities that have been on it for 17, 18 years to go out to them and develop some source of either alternate power or something to wean them off this program?
We are working with communities in terms of developing hybrid systems. I guess the best example that I have in the very successful project was the Metlakatla project down in southeast. We put a hybrid system in there, which was a battery hydro diesel generated system. And when we got the battery system hooked up, that system began to save Metlakatla $40,000 a month in terms of their fuel costs alone. So that in itself cut the demand to PC on fuel costs allowables, and in addition cut the demand on the kilowatt side. So we did make a positive step in terms of reducing the demand to PCE. What we're doing with the smaller communities is we're trying to get systems in those communities where we move them away from diesel generation and lower their cost per kilowatt hour. And in doing so, if they fall underneath the floor for the PCE program, they will be off the program. And that's kind of the goal we're working at right now, is how do we implement and develop and install these hybrid systems.